Hello, and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast shining a light on developers' lives from all over the world. My name is Tim Bourguignon, and today I receive Eric Saint-Martin. Eric has spent the last decade building and securing distributed systems for large enterprises, such as cable providers, credit bureaus, and fraud detection companies. He now works for Microsoft as a senior cloud developer advocate. He co-authored a book on the Go programming language. He co-authored podcast with GoTime FM, and he organizes GopherCon, the annual conference for the Go community. Eric, welcome to Dev Journey.
Thanks for having me.
So, Eric, I have three questions for you. The first one would be, how did you end up in security? That's always interesting to me. The second one would be, what do you do at Microsoft, actually, this developer advocate stuff? And how did you jump ship and end up at Microsoft? And the final one would be, where does this passion for the Go language come from? And I would say maybe you should start with telling us where you come from, your background and stuff.
Sure. So the security side of things, I guess I wouldn't say that's my primary role. It's something I do a lot of as a kind of secondary role. A lot of my primary role is software engineering and systems architecture. But I got into programming because of security, actually. I was probably about 14, I think. And we got our first computer in the house. And like every teenage kid, I was obsessed with the idea of hacking and playing pranks and things like that. And I can actually tell you some fun stories of things I did to friends and things I did to school computers that I probably shouldn't have.
Do you want to tell that in public?
Sure, I've told these stories before. So there was one time we had a CAD class, and I happened to stay home sick. But I had loaded a Trojan onto all of the computers in this CAD classroom, and the classroom was configured in like this U shape. So I went through and I started turning monitors off like in a row, drawing a line around the room and then back on and then opening CD-ROM drives and closing them again. And I thought it was hilarious. And I didn't think about the fact that my CAD teacher knew that I was pretty proficient with computers, and I just happened to be out the day that this happened. And it was pretty funny because the next day when I went back to school, he's like, "Really funny, Eric." He's like, "You know, you're staying after school and removing whatever you put on all of those computers, right?" But so I was commonly like pranking people like that. And I had a roommate once where I changed the mouse cursor, you know, it turns to the hand when you're pointing at something. Well, I had changed his to a middle finger, and it actually took him like 2 months before he noticed. But yeah, so I mean, I was always obsessed with that stuff. And so I grew up without a lot of money. So we didn't have the money to buy all these new computer games and things like that that were coming out. So I used to borrow friends of mine. And at the time, CD-ROM drives were not fast enough to just read a game off of. So when you installed a game, everything got copied to your hard drive. So there were these things called no CD cracks back then that would basically just patch the binary to stop looking at the CD-ROM drive to check if the disk was in there. So I started learning how to do that when I was about 14 or 15 so that I could borrow friends' games and have them. That was before people were being chased after for pirating music and stuff. So it was a different time. I don't know whether I would do that now, but it was really interesting to get into it. And then the internet kind of started getting popular in the mid to late 90s. And so I kind of got fascinated with websites and building websites and started learning HTML and CSS. And then I wanted to be able to make them function and dynamic. And so there were bulletin board software programs and things like that that were out at the time. And I had one. And so I used to just patch it to add features and things like that. And it started out by following tutorials on how to add this new functionality to these bulletin boards. And then after a while, I started trying to learn the languages that they were implemented in so that I could understand it more. And it was really interesting for me because, I mean, I don't come from a family that went to college and has these types of careers. So I never really thought I'd end up there. I worked in factories and fast food restaurants and things like that through most of my late teens and I guess a little bit my early 20s. And people started offering me money to do programming work for them. And then I sort of fell into it as a career. And my I remember my first programming job was like $10 an hour or something like that. And I call it programming job, but really it was like IT extraordinaire. it was fixing printer jams. It was programming stuff. It was, you know, installing telephony equipment and things like that. And that was really kind of how I got my break. And I guess through most of my career, I was constantly doing things that I didn't think I should have been doing because of my background. I dropped out of high school. So I never went to college for this stuff. And I just always assumed that this career was a career for people who, you know, had that formal education. And I remember one time where I was doing freelance work and things like that. And I would do temp jobs as a programmer for, you know, healthcare companies and stuff. And I remember getting a call from a recruiter from Disney. I was like, there's no way I'm qualified to do this. And the recruiter convinced me that I should try anyway. And to my surprise, I got the job. And I worked there for about 5 years on all of the Disney's reservation systems for Disney World and ended up leading teams and things like that. I got to work on the teams that did all the magic bands before those came out. That was really interesting. Spent 2 years where I couldn't tell family and friends what I was working on.
Wow.
So I guess from there, it's just been a progression where, you know, I started kind of on the front end side and I've been more and more fascinated with lower level stuff. So I started doing kind of web development and then kind of moved into systems programming and distributed systems programming and kind of deeper down the security route. And I even play with hardware in my spare time. Which surprisingly, you can learn a lot about being a better software developer by learning to write firmware for very small hardware.
Indeed, you can. Indeed, you can.
That was one of the questions. I'm trying to remember the other two. One of them was how I ended up at Microsoft, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Microsoft, they stole me from Comcast, which is one of the biggest cable providers here in the United States. I was doing a lot of interesting Kubernetes stuff, writing custom control plane components and kind of designing and helping build this, you know, several thousand node system for doing video streaming. And I also was very active in the open source world. So contributing to Kubernetes, contributing to Docker, contributing to Go. My first big open source contribution was in 2009, maybe 2010, doing the unobtrusive JavaScript and jQuery support for Rails 3. So Microsoft was spinning up this whole developer advocacy group. And they were just kind of scooping up a lot of people that had backgrounds in interesting areas. So Go and containers and Kubernetes was big for them. So they approached me and it was one of those things where it's like, we know you like going out and doing, speaking about these things and contributing to these things. How would you like to spend more of your time doing that? And I was like, well, that sounds amazing. But it was an interesting move for me because I've mostly come from an open source background. I am through and through a Linux person. I have been running Linux on the desktop since the late 90s. The last version of Windows I used to any degree was Windows XP. So it was an interesting move, but I really like where Microsoft's going. They're kind of getting back to the love of developers. I can't really say getting back to, that's not fair to them because they've always loved developers and they've always thrown a ton of money at the experience for developers. They were just focused on their community, you know, Windows developers. And now it's kind of because of the cloud and what the cloud has done, it's now a much broader pool of developers that they're trying to do this for. So, yeah, and I really love the role. So because of the way I came into tech and things like that, I love the idea of kind of helping the generations behind, like coming up behind me, and how can I share some of these lessons learned, you know, some of them through the school of hard knocks with the newer generation of people. So, and developer advocacy is actually really interesting because there's a couple of parts. A lot of people see kind of, sometimes it gets a false perception with like this kind of rock star mentality. You travel around the world and speak at conferences and things like that. And that's sort of the public view of what people see. But there's also the internal side of things. So what we really do is we go out and we try to help educate people, but we also try to meet people and understand the types of problems that they're experiencing, the types of things that they're trying to build. In particular, the struggles that they're having with products, say that Microsoft and Azure have. And then we go back, and a lot of what's not seen is we spend a lot of time in meetings with product managers and things like that, trying to provide back this feedback from the community and help them evolve the products in ways, whether that's adding features or fixing bugs, whether that's working with the documentation teams to provide better documentation on things to help make the experience better for our customers and for people who could potentially be customers.
What surprised you the most by coming to work for Microsoft?
What surprised me the most? I've learned a lot about the areas that they invest money in. I guess it wasn't always visible to me just how much they cared about developers and developer experience, and that it wasn't all kind of motivated by profits and things like that. And the speed at which they amassed this crazy team of advocates was also really, really surprising. It's just this massive group of just ridiculously smart people with crazy backgrounds and accomplishments. And I feel like most of us feel like we're the one person who doesn't belong on the team that they just haven't found out yet.
Yeah, that's another question I wanted to ask. I wanted to ask you before, when you finally lost this inferiority complex that you were talking about, but with your comment right now, I have the feeling it's kind of still here.
It is very much still here. I think it's really, really... So the internet has connected us in amazing ways, but I think that it's also possibly been detrimental, right? Because you used to look at the people directly around you, family, close friends, neighbors, and that's sort of how you saw your place in the world. And now we're constantly looking at this highly curated list of the best the world has to offer. And it's really, really easy to feel out of place, like we just haven't accomplished these things. There's also false perceptions, right? You see what myself or other people who are in kind of the public view, you see what we post, right? And I may give a talk on a topic, or somebody else may give a talk on a topic, and we assume that they must know everything there is to know about that topic. But the talk itself for the blog post could encompass 100% of what they know, right? We draw lines that aren't necessarily there. I remember during one of our podcast episodes where I was talking about hardware projects I was working on, and I think somebody DM'd me or something and was like, "You know hardware too?" And it's like, I know a little bit of hardware, enough to be dangerous. But you see these things and you assume that you must be an expert on all of these. So I'm starting to recognize that even when I look at other people that I admire, that I'm making assumptions about all of their knowledge. And, you know, a lot of these people have head starts on me. I'm never going to catch up unless they just stop learning. And I've been trying to be more okay with comparing myself to me a year ago or 2 years ago, and how have I progressed rather than comparing myself to others. But it's hard. There's oftentimes I look at people, I'm like, I wish I had that knowledge. And to some degree, I think the way I came into computing, not having a formal education, probably hurts me a little bit too, where I feel like because I don't have the formal education, I'm not qualified to be here or something, even though I know how insane that sounds.
Have you read the book from Rob Connery, I think? The Imposter? Oh, God.
Yeah, Imposter's Handbook, yeah.
Imposter Handbook, exactly. Have you heard this one?
Yes, yes. And there's a second version of it out, too, or is coming out.
I think you're right, yeah, with Scott Hanselman, maybe, co-written. Something like this. I was fascinated with the first story, because it's really what you said is Rob doesn't have a background, a college background either. And he felt like an imposter for a while. And he felt he had the need to write this book to get into those topics, those low level topics that are key to a CS a master's degree. To have the feeling to belong, which I find amazing and horrifying at the same time. That amazing that he did it, and horrifying that he felt he had the need to do it.
Have you heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Yes, I have. Like, can you please explain it for the audience?
Sure. So it basically says that. So there's kind of two sides of it. So there's the one side where often people who have minimal knowledge about a subject overestimate their knowledge or ability in that field because they don't understand how kind of vast it is. And then you have the opposite side of it, whereas the more you learn about a particular subject, the more you realize that you don't know. And it becomes very, very easy to feel like an imposter because all you can see are all of the areas of this subject that you don't know. And it makes the amount that you do know seem so minuscule.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if I look back at my career, I had a lot more confidence in myself early in my career. So I think it fits.
And how do you boost your confidence nowadays?
So nowadays I spend less time looking at other people and where they're at and knowledge that I wish I had, and just more being excited about the things that I'm doing and how does that compare to me a year ago? You know, am I learning new things? Am I evolving? Are these the things that I want to be learning? And things like that. It's more one of those the journey is more important than the destination. And I think as I started getting into the career and advancing, I got so caught up on reaching the kind of end goal, which is hard because you're constantly moving. You're constantly moving the line, right? So it's impossible. And I forgot what really got me into programming, which was just the love of creating things and the excitement of learning new things. And you know, that 10, 20 hours of fighting with somebody, and then you just feel like a rock star when you finally figure it out.
I know the feeling, yes. That's very true.
Even when it's a missing semicolon.
Yes, because you learn something along the way.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So those are the things that I actually love. I love the type of projects where I feel like I've been kicked into the deep end and I have to figure out how to swim.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a lot of those?
Probably the past few months, no. But those are the types of jobs that I do enjoy. And that's what intrigued me about the job at Comcast. You know, I was approached about that and it was like, well, I don't know anything about cable video streaming and video multiplexing. So, okay, I'll do it.
So here's the plane. Here's a parachute. The plane's going down. Now try to learn how to put it on. but
that's the way it works. If you're not, if you're not challenging yourself, you're not growing. And so I had a friend who was, in school for computer science, and you know, at one point he wasn't sure, like, it was, you know, something he was cut out for, like, you're just a natural at it or you're not. And one of the things I said to him was, the difference between a senior programmer and a junior programmer isn't the amount that you struggle. It's that a senior programmer has become comfortable in the struggle, that it's just something you've accepted as part of your day-to-day job. And so it doesn't give you as much anxiety just because you realize it's part of the process. And I think in the beginning, when you're struggling a lot, you feel like there's a lot of struggle. Maybe this isn't for me. Maybe I'm not, you know, a natural at this.
That's an interesting take on seniority.
When you think about it, you've been in the field a number of years. Do you feel like you struggle any less now than you did then?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And if you're not struggling, it's probably because you're working on the type of thing that you've built 20 times already, and you could do it in your sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't remember who said that, but now there's the seniority with 20 years of experience, and there's the seniority wins 20 times the first year of experience.
Yeah.
Which amounts for the same thing in the end. Yeah, that's very true. I had...
Those are the times when I'm disappointed with myself, when I look at like 5 years gone past, and I'm like, what did I do that's new? And the answer is nothing.
Is it true though?
Oh, I mean, not in this particular case, but I'm saying in the past when I've kind of looked at my progress over the past couple, like over a couple year period, if I feel like I haven't grown or learned anything, those are the points where I'm disappointed with myself. It's not because of the accomplishments that I have yet to achieve. It's more in the not experiencing growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can relate to that. You said before, if you're not challenging yourself, you're not growing. But is there something, is there such thing as challenging yourself too much?
I definitely think there is. I think that even outside of our careers, just as people, we're in such a hurry to get to the finish line that we cause ourselves a lot of stress and anxiety. We give up a lot of our personal lives, and you start to realize as you get older, I'm 35 now, but like as you start to get into your 30s and things like that, you start to realize that time is the only currency that matters. Like, you need to have time for your family. You need to have time for hobbies and friends and things like that. In my early 20s, I was all computers all the time. I just, you know, and now I intentionally try to step back and appreciate things that are outside of computers.
Mm-hmm.
Although I keep trying to come up with hobbies and convince myself that they're hobbies. And then I have to be like, Eric, that's computer stuff. Hardware. Doing hardware is still computer stuff, Eric.
That is true. I heard this comment a few days ago from somebody who said, well, her doctor told her she should pull the plug a bit and cool down. And her first thought was, yeah, more time for my project. And then just thought about it for a second. She, oh no, that's what he meant. Oh boy. So what have you taken on as a non-computer science hobby?
So since I was a teenager, I've wanted to learn to play the guitar well, and I put it down for a number of years, and then probably about 10 years ago, I picked it up again, and then, of course, I let work consume me again, and organizing a conference, and, you know, at one time I was working multiple jobs and things like that, that kind of prevented me from doing it. And then recently, I started telling myself, if I had put in 30 minutes to an hour a day when I started getting back into the guitar a decade ago, then I would be pretty good by now.
Yes, you would.
So here we go again. I'm trying to get back into it again. But yeah, I love music, and I've always loved acoustic stuff. So I really enjoy that.
Interesting. Do you see some parallels between what you learn or the way you learn guitar and your day-to-day job?
Oh, without a doubt. So you pick stuff and you're like, oh, the guitar, it's artistic, and, you know, it's totally different from what I do for my day job. And then you start looking at it and you're like, there's a lot of technical stuff there too, right? It's a lot of stuff going on and understanding the mechanics of things. And then because of the way my mind works, like, I want to know the theory. I want to know the music theory. Why do these notes sound good together? You know, things like that. So I guess it's easy to kind of fall into that stuff because it's highly technical with a lot of detail that you learn. Of course, you could just pick it up and play, right? But that's probably not me.
One thing I would like to go back to is how you fell down into the Go world. Is there a story behind that?
So when it first was released in late 2009, I was working at Disney at the time, and myself and a couple colleagues kind of got together and we looked at it, and it was interesting, but we didn't really see what the huge selling point was. You know, what do we get out of this that we don't get from one of the many languages we're using already? So that was one of the things tinkered. And then kind of let it be. Probably was it two years later, something like that. I started working for this credit bureau, and this is where I met Brian Kettleson, who organizes GopherCon with me, and is one of the two other co-authors of Go in Action. And I guess he had tinkered with Go and had built this little pet microservice in it. But he was the CIO of the company, so he didn't exactly have a lot of time to maintain this thing. And so when I started there, he was like, would you be willing to learn Go and kind of take this on? This service is getting slammed. It's a lot more popular than it was when I first wrote it. So I was like, sure. And so I picked up Go and started maintaining that. And it was really through the process of building software with it that I really started to fall in love with it. And that's the really, really hard part, especially in the beginning. Now it's easier to sell people on Go. Most people have heard it. They've heard lots of people adopt it. And so it's easier to be like, well, I'll give it a try. But back then, you know, there wasn't a lot of people using Go. So yeah, there wasn't a silver bullet. There wasn't one thing I could tell you on an elevator. You have to use Go because of this. So really, it was through the process of writing software, kind of everything that the language provided and everything that wasn't in the language really sort of made me fall in love with it. And a couple years passed, did a lot more Go development, and we started... Brian and I started talking about the fact that there's no Go conferences, and like, we love going to these language conferences, and kind of put it off. And I don't know, maybe about 6 months or a year later, somebody on Twitter is like, I really wish there was a Go conference. And Brian and I are responding like, I know we keep saying this, and I forget how it exactly happened. I'd have to pull up the thread, but it was basically one of those, like, I dare you to do it, or why don't you do it? And so Brian and I went in his office and we had a conversation about, like, how hard could it be, right? It's just a conference. It turns out the answer is very hard. They are a lot of work. They are a lot of money. They are a lot of risk. So we started this little conference called GopherCon. And the name was basically because the one thing we didn't want was we didn't want one of these kind of for-profit conferences. Not that I think it's wrong for people to make profit, but you know, the type of conferences where like almost every talk is a vendor pitch. The sponsorships are sold by giving speaking slots and things like that. And we didn't want that. We wanted a community-run conference. So we set out to do that, and Go programmers call themselves Gophers. So hence the name GopherCon. And we expected, you know, 100, maybe 200 people. The community just did not seem big back then. This was mid-2013 when we started planning this. And Mitchell Hashimoto was the first person to buy tickets, which we thought was amazing. We all loved him because of Vagrant and things like that. And we're just like, whoa. But yeah, a lot of people jumped on. Sponsors were just like, we're happy to give you money just to make this happen and things like that. We ended up having almost, it was over 700 people. I think it was just shy of 750. our first year. We had to keep rearranging things and getting AV and the caterers involved to accommodate these more people. We never expected it to be that big its very first year. And then it just sort of took off and other people started spinning up Gopher Cons in other countries and the language itself took off. So there's a lot of this. I loved the language. Brian loved the language. We knew that it was different and it was going to change things, but I don't think any of us could have anticipated that it would grow, you know, to the extent it is now, where most programmers have at least heard of the language. You know, in those early days, every conversation was, "What's Go?" So I'm thankful I don't have to have that conversation on repeat anymore.
But you would do it again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I really love the fact that I found Go because it also made me find containers and Kubernetes very, very early on. We had containers in production in like late 2014 or something like that. It was crazy. I mean, nobody should have had containers in production that early, but, and all of that was because of the love of Go. Go was so new back then. Brian and I used to just kind of scroll GitHub looking for new projects that were created in Go and, came across this thing called Docker, and it was like, huh. At the time, I was working on trying to build this framework for building distributed systems, because not everybody wants to work on all of that stuff, but there's plenty of amazing programmers. So we're trying to work on this framework where if you implemented the client and the server a particular way, you didn't have to worry about all the service discovery and retry logic and exponential backoff and circuit breakers and all of these things. You just had to write the client or, you know, the individual API calls on the server side. And it worked great for Go because we just had to deploy a binary, but we had other services that were written in Ruby and things like that. And things were a lot more complicated. And how do we bundle up this application and deploy it to, you know, a random server? And so when Docker came out, it was just like, holy crap, this is the perfect solution to this problem. And so kind of fell in love with that. And then Kubernetes came along and it was like, whoa, that's a way better way of doing what we were trying to do with the framework. So threw all of that out and kind of started using Kubernetes. But yeah, and those both ended up becoming crazy popular. But all of that and the early use of it just came from looking for interesting projects that were written in Go.
That's a very cool story, actually. It's really impressive how things can move from one perceivably lucky move to another, and just from being at the right place at the right time with the right mindset and your eyes open, then you can stumble on something really interesting, and from there on it can have a very, very huge effect on the rest of your life, actually.
Yeah, and there's so much of life that's a door opening, and you have to recognize that the door opened and take a little bit of risk to peek in there and be like, what's behind this door? And my career has been a lot of that, where an opportunity presents itself, you know, to do something slightly different from what I was doing before. And I try it. And here's the thing. We're all afraid of like ruining our lives, right? Like making this a bad decision that's going to ruin the rest of our lives. But if you're really honest with yourself in your 20s, even in your 30s, there's very little you can do to like ruin your entire life unless you let it, right? You may make a decision that causes hard times on yourself, and it may be a real struggle to get out of. It may take a long time to get out of, but it's not going to ruin the rest of your life unless you let it. So, you know, I've tried to live that way, where something seems interesting, it's slightly different from what I'm doing. How do I know what I really, really want to do for the rest of my life unless I try some stuff? And so Microsoft was, you know, a prime example of that. I knew I'd do a lot more public speaking and things like that. I'm traditionally more of just an engineer. I just like working on interesting and hard problems. I never really wanted to be in public view. But I've always loved mentoring people too. So that was one of those risks I took, that I could completely hate public speaking, you know, and, but what's the worst that happens? I decide this isn't for me, but I tried it. You know, I don't think that there's a company in the world that's going to be like, well, you went and tried this public speaking thing and you didn't like it, so you can't be an engineer anymore, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to I totally agree with what you say, but I'm trying to match that up with the advice I would give someone in high school right now that is really interested in programming and says, well, I don't see how college would help me. Would the advice be just try it, take this opening door and just don't go into your studies and do it? Or would it still be interesting? What would you say to such a person?
So this is actually a topic I've been very conflicted about, because I wouldn't say just because I didn't go to school doesn't mean that people shouldn't, and things like that. I think there's a couple of questions you need to ask yourself, right? One is, what way do you find best to learn? For some people, that's formal education. Here's the class, here's the book you need to read, here's the test, right? And then other people are a lot more hands-on learning through failure types of people. So if you're more of that type of person, you may get bored with school, right? It may be a struggle for you. But you still have to invest the time, right? You can't get around the time investment of learning. It's just the process in which you learn. You know, secondly, having a degree can be beneficial, especially breaking into the field. Nowadays, I actually have a huge problem with the fact that many companies don't hire juniors anymore, which I hate, because I think the number one use of a senior is to create more seniors. But a lot of people, like every company, just wants seniors, and we're not, you know, how do we make more seniors if we're not hiring juniors? So having that degree can be a good foot in the door, unless you have like a wildly successful open source project and people know who you are and things like that. It can be a challenge. But I think another thing with college that can be beneficial for people is, if you're not sure what area of computer science you're interested in, it's a very good way to get exposure to a lot of areas and figure out what area you might want to work in. You know, for me, it's been kind of this working my way down the stack, right? Like, so I got into web development, and then I got into, you know, systems programming and things like that. And I've been moving further and further down the stack. Now I actually want to learn more about compilers and things like that. But that's sort of like an evolution over my career. Had I just went through a couple years of school, hit all of these things, I may have found an area that I loved more. So yeah, I mean, I think coming into tech, probably the hardest decision to make is what area you want to focus in. And I see it all the time. What language should I learn? Should I learn web development? Should I learn IoT? Should I, you know, on and on and on. People don't really know what area to get into. So I think more importantly is just finding something. Find a project you're passionate about right now and work on it and learn all of the things, because you're not walling yourself off into some area as much as you think you are. A lot of these things start creating foundations where learning other areas of technology become much, much easier. There's a talk that Katrina Owen gave at GopherCon called Minding the Gap. And it's really, really interesting if you get a chance to watch that, because she basically talks about how knowledge is really like a graph, where each of these things that we learn, we're putting a dot on our graph. And then a lot of times for people, these things aren't connected, but some new piece of information comes in and it allows us to make connections that weren't previously there. And that's why it appears like some people learn these things really, really fast. And it's not necessarily their natural aptitude for it. It's just that they already had this other knowledge and they were able to draw some connections and make sense of it faster.
That is fascinating. I will have a look at this talk and put the talk in the show notes. Absolutely. Thank you for that. And unfortunately, we have reached the end of our time box, and it was a fantastic discussion. Before we wrap up, where can people talk to you or contact you if they want to know more about your story?
Yeah, I'm on, if you're in the Go world, I'm on the Gopher Slack. My handle's Eric St. Martin. It's my whole name, no punctuation, jammed together. My Twitter handle is the same thing, E-R-I-K-S-T-M-A-R-T-I-N. My DMs are open. I'm happy to answer questions. I'm always happy to mentor people, especially if you're kind of coming up the way I did, where you're maybe a high school dropout and kind of worried that you won't be able to achieve certain things.
Mm-hmm. And do you have anything on your plate in the coming months that you would like to advertise here?
I'm doing a bunch of talks at Microsoft conferences, Ignite, the tour. My next two, one of them will be done by the time this airs, and then in Mexico City in mid-April, which I think, but GopherCon, so that's in late July in San Diego this year.
Go GopherCon. Cool. Well, then thank you very much. That was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for so much for having me.
And this has been another episode of Developer's Journey, and we'll see each other in 2 weeks. Bye-bye. Dear listener, if you haven't subscribed yet, you can find this podcast on iTunes, Google Music, Stitcher, Spotify, and much more. Head over to www.devjourney.info to read the show notes, find all the links mentioned during the episode, and of course, links to the podcast on all those platforms. Don't miss the next Developer's Journey story by subscribing to the podcast with the app of your choice right now. And if you like what we do, please rate the podcast, write a comment on those platforms, and promote the podcast on social media. This really helps fellow developers discover the podcast and those fantastic journeys. Thank you.